Robinson, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Robinson for Appellant Bureau of Land Management. The district court in this case held that Section 4 of the Open Government Act applies retroactively to pre-enactment conduct. And this court in Summers versus Department of Justice held that it does not. Therefore, the district court must be reversed. In Summers, this court held that to apply the Open Government Act to pre-enactment conduct would increase the government's liability for past conduct, and that there is no evidence that Congress intended that result. The Supreme Court, moreover, a number of times has held that the in order for an act or piece of legislation to apply to pending litigation, the legislation must specifically mention retroactivity.
Let me ask you, what's the key act that we should be looking at here? Is it disclosure or the stipulation? I mean, obviously, you've taken a side on that. What evidence there is there in the text of the statute to support your view?
I rely mostly on the analysis of the Open Government Act by this court in Summers. That court said, and also the Supreme Court in Landgraf said.
How does Summers tell us to look to disclosure rather than the end of the litigation?
It says to look to the conduct that occurred before the legislation became effective. And
that sort of jumps to the conclusion here. If the relevant conduct is the conduct that occurred after the act took place, then we don't have a retroactivity problem then, do we?
That is true. Your Honor, all of the conduct in this litigation occurred prior to December 31st, 2007. The only possible conduct that occurred after December 31st, 2007 was the filing of a stipulation.
The end of the litigation, right?
That stipulation, however, was not the kind of settlement that gives rise to any kind of liability. It was only a housekeeping measure that asked for the entry of judgment in favor of the defendant, in favor of the government. All that was required at that point was the acknowledgement. All that happened at that point was the acknowledgement by the parties that the court should enter judgment and conclude the case because the case at that point was moot. The only other conduct, in fact, there's nothing in the application for attorney's fees that refers to any post enactment conduct except for the preparation of the
In Summers wasn't the relevant event the end of the litigation? I mean, normally don't you think that that's the end of the litigation, that's when you now have a sense of the accounting for the attorney's fees that is resolved, and so at that point you pursue the attorney's fees?
No, I believe, Your Honor, that if you look to the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf and in this court's decision, while those cases did involve a settlement agreement that occurred, and therefore you were looking to see what the parties intended at that point. What the court in Landgraf and what this court was concerned with was that you would penalize the defendant for conduct that occurred at a time when the law was different. And in this case, the conduct that occurred was the disclosure of documents.
There's no question the disclosure occurred before the act. But the point I'm getting at is that the relevant conduct we should be looking at? You know, Justice Scalia asked the question, retroactive as to what? And I'm trying to get your best argument for why you think the relevant conduct here is the disclosure as opposed to the end of the litigation.
What penalizes when a defendant acts, in this case voluntarily disclosing information, he's acting under the understanding that the law at this point is protecting that disclosure and not going to confer prevailing party status on the plaintiff. All the law that is relevant at that point of the conduct means that the government would not be liable for fees. If it were at the other thing that the Supreme Court has stated is that it also talks about pending litigation in both Martin versus Haydix and in the case Graham County that we submitted in a 28J letter. The court says in order to apply to pending litigation, the the legislation must specifically mention retroactivity. Therefore,
let me ask you about this, the stipulation. I guess, would say it was mainly a formalization of what had already occurred. That is, the plaintiff won when the plaintiff got the documents back in September, immediately after filing suit. And if is that, that is your position. And
that is
I think Summers, in its discussion of the calculus and what does the government, goes into the government's calculus, if it's thinking, well, we're going to give these documents up, we're not facing attorney's fees. And so that jibes with Summers. But what about the language that is put into the stipulation about attorney's fees? What's your position on that? Do you think the parties, because the defendant agreed, yes, you can apply for attorney's fees, and the plaintiff agreed, and yes, you can oppose the application, that the two parties just sort of kicked it down the road as to what the Open Government Act, if any, what effect, if any?
Your Honor, all the stipulation does is to say that the plaintiff is free to file an application, then the government is free to oppose the application. I would note at page 11 of the joint appendix, again, that the plaintiff said that it had elected not to challenge the scope of the supplemental searches that the government undertook. Accordingly, entry of judgment in defendant's favor is appropriate at this time. Even the plaintiff understood that the stipulation was simply ending the case in the government's favor. The other kinds of settlement agreements that this court has suggested produce some sort of future result for the defendant are those in which the government has promised the release of documents, for example, in the future or on a particular date or by a particular timetable. Here, there's nothing. All that we have here is that the court is going to close the book on this case, and the stipulation doesn't affect anything, doesn't require anything. The court in Summers talked about the fact that the court has the defendant is under an obligation to do something in the future that's important, and here there's just simply nothing like that. And I just want to mention briefly that the other two issues that the court below raised, and that is that it held that the new act created some sort of new standard for eligibility and entitlement. It collapsed those two together. But this court in Summers held that the act incorporates simply the traditional catalyst theory under which there has to be a causal nexus between the lawsuit and the disclosure. We also believe that the district court abused its discretion in finding that that Judicial Watch was entitled to attorney's fees because, in this case, there was no obdurate behavior on the part of the government, and there was no basis for finding that the delay was anything other than the ordinary delay that the agency.
But don't we owe some deference to the district court's finding that the Bureau was less than diligent here?
Your Honor, the district court undertook no new findings. All we have a declaration here by a government official that unless there is some cause to find new evidence, that must be taken as true, and the district court did not do that. In this case, therefore, that deference of the discretion of the district court, we believe, was abused.
I take it your argument is that the catalyst theory is at work here, that we're supposed to read the amendment through the Open Government Act to now embody the catalyst theory. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, what support does the catalyst theory have in the text of the statute?
The old statute, the provision that still remains of the old statute says that the court may assess reasonable fees. That the defendant, that the plaintiff must obtain relief through a voluntary change in conduct, and the legislative history still says that.
We'll get to legislative history later. I'm just talking just the text. Is there anything in the text of the statute that that supports the catalyst theory?
Well, Your Honor,
as I read the statute, it just says there has to be a substantial complaint and a release by the government, right? Just looking at the text.
Yes, Your Honor. It says that there must be a release, but it says there should be relief through the voluntary disclosure. We believe that that sort of that language supports.
There's no language of causation in the statute. Is there? So now let's get to you. Where do you get your argument from that there has to be some causal link between the filing of the complaint and the voluntary disclosure?
In the statutory text itself, other than that through language and the fact that the court may award it in fees, it doesn't specifically say that there must be.
Yeah, you have to go to legislative history, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the fact that this court in Summers said that Congress amended the FOIA to incorporate the catalyst theory, we believe that holding is also binding.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Bekesha on behalf of Judicial Watch. On December 31st, 2007, the Open Government Act of 2007 took effect. On January 7th, 2008, the two parties filed a joint stipulation and settled the case. Judicial Watch subsequently filed a motion for an award of attorney's fees. Since the settlement occurred after the enactment of the 2007 Act, the fee-shifting provision does not operate retroactively. Judicial Watch isn't re-arguing Summers. Judicial Watch solely requests that this court apply the law in effect when the settlement took place.
Isn't your problem, though, speaking of law in effect, Summers? I mean, Summers says, Judge Griffith was having this discussion with your opposing counsel about what act we're talking about, when it occurred, right?
Yes.
And Summers says, Summers refers to the government, quote, calculus. It says its decision to settle reflects a calculation. When in this case was that calculus, that decision made?
I'm unsure when the government's calculus was made, calculation was made. However, Judicial Watch forfeited their right.
Yeah, but isn't it pretty obvious that the calculation that they're not talking about a decision the plaintiff makes. They're talking about, in Summers, its decision reflects a calculation. That's the decision by the agency.
That's correct.
So when did that occur in this case?
It would have occurred after the plaintiff informed the government that they were no longer challenging the scope of the search or any of the exemptions.
And that was all pre-December 31?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor.
Was it?
The government turned over a few affidavits in December 19th, 2007, Judicial Watch then reviewed the affidavits, mm-hmm. and on January 7th, the two parties decided to settle. Uh-huh. During that period, it was unclear how the litigation was going to proceed. It was only after Judicial Watch
We go back to my discussion about the language of Summers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The calculation the agency made here, that is, the moment at which the agency would have taken into account the possibility of attorney's fees. That's the calculation the court is talking about in Summers.
That occurred
in September, didn't it? When the government turned over the documents.
I don't believe it did. No? Under Summers, this court looked to the settlement of the cases.
In that case, they were similar. Here you have a stipulation that came after the act was passed. That's just a report. The facts are different in the case. The calculation here that the government's talking about, I just don't see where that, how you could make the case that occurred any time other than in September. That's where it made this balance.
And in Summers, didn't the, right. The settlement occur at the same time as the disclosure? You didn't have the yeah. separation in time that we have here. Isn't that right?
That is correct. Summers, for all intents and purposes, was over in 2005. The facts here are very different. The stipulation wasn't filed until after the act. Judicial Watch did not forego their right to seek, to request any additional searches or challenge any of the exemptions. If settlement did not occur on January 7th, the government would have had to file a dispositive motion on that day.
Well, that's all true, but that isn't the way Summers instructs us to look at the case. You're just suggesting an alternative to Summers. I mean, we're bound by Summers, and Summers says we're to look at the date at which the government's calculation occurred. That is, its calculation over whether or not to disclose balanced against its liability, potential liability for fees. That's the binding principle that operates here. I mean, your theory is interesting, but I don't see how we can look at it that way, given Summers.
Isn't the only way that you can prevail under Summers is if you can convince us that the relevant calculation was made at settlement and not at disclosure?
That is correct.
So how do you do that? How do you persuade us of that?
The language in Summers didn't talk about the calculation of the government producing documents. It talked about the calculation made at settlement.
No, it didn't. It says the government calculus would have been different had it known that Buckhannon did not apply. Its decision to settle reflects the calculation. See? I don't see how you can make the point that they did that on January 7th or whatever the date of the stipulation was. Try. What is the argument?
I think the argument would be between, even after the documents were produced in September, the litigation continued. The conduct of both parties continued. Yeah. In October, the two parties conferred. They discussed the adequacy of the search. Yeah. At that time, the government went back, performed an additional search.
Right.
And then in December, the government provided two additional affidavits.
Right.
Judicial Watch then looked at the affidavits, looked at the documents, and on January 7th determined that they were not going to challenge any of the search. Judicial Watch could have challenged the search, and the litigation would have continued. It's just because in this instance, it's easier to look in hindsight that it appears as though the relevant conduct occurred in September or maybe October or maybe December. But between December and January, neither party knew how the litigation was going to proceed. It was only at that point on January 7th when the joint stipulation was filed that the litigation was final, it was complete, and the parties could evaluate their positions. I would also like to note that the government's brief in Davis, which is being heard after this, on pages 11 and 26.
Can I back up? Am I right that before Summers you argued that the relevant time was disclosure? That the position you're taking now, that the relevant time for our inquiry is at the time of the settlement? But that's a new argument. You didn't bring that before Summers, right?
Judicial Watch was opposing the government's argument before the district court. Our position hasn't changed that the 2007 Act should apply in this instance. So I wouldn't say that this is a new argument. It's just another argument that we are asserting. No, it's not a new argument. But in the Davis case, the government's brief talks about on pages 11 and 26 that it's not the filing date, the release date, or even the date the motion for fees is filed. Also on page 18, it talks about the law in effect when the court makes its decision and not, for example, when the case was filed or when the releases were made. So I believe Judicial Watch's position today is no different than the government's position in Davis. that the relevant date is the settlement when the case became final. It is an easy way for the court to assess what the most critical date is.
I understand that. That's a very interesting way to approach it. You haven't yet convinced me how we can get there given Summers. That's my hang-up with what your argument is. I see your point. It would be really easy if we just said, look, it's the date of the stipulation. We look at that date. It has a date on it. We don't have to do any analysis or get second or guessing about what the parties may have intended. That may be a much better way to do it. But Summers doesn't say that.
Summers talks about the settlement. And the other difference with Summers is it was complete in 2005. It was only on appeal.
Well, that's because the facts of the cases were different.
Facts of the case were different.
Yeah. Right.
And Judicial Watch, and because the facts are different, the case can be distinguished. In this instance, the relevant conduct occurred after the enactment of the 2007 Act. The litigation was still ongoing at the time the statute was passed. And I'll say again, between September and January, the litigation was active and alive. It wasn't until the finality of the joint settlement and the cases were settled that both parties were able to assess their positions. Also, the 2007 Act didn't alter the two-part test of the fee-shifting provision. There's still a requirement that the complaint be eligible for as well as entitled to fees. The entitlement aspect comes at the beginning of the statute, Section 4, when it talks about the court may assess. That hasn't changed. There's still, under the reading of the 2007 Act, the district court still has discretion in awarding attorneys' fees. This act, the 2007 Act, only changed the substantially prevailed or the eligibility requirement. This court in Summers did not need to apply the 2007 Act because they found that it could not be retroactively applied. Therefore, it did not analyze, discuss, or hold that the new statute incorporated the catalyst theory. Under the plain language reading of the statute, there is no cause and effect element. As long as the claim is substantial and a suit has been filed, if the government turns over records after the suit has been filed, the requester is eligible for attorney's fees. Because of the case law, Congress could have created a cause and effect language and put it in the statute. It could have said that the lawsuit was reasonably necessary and the litigation substantially caused the requested records to be released. It didn't do so. It didn't put that language in there.
The legislative history suggests otherwise. I mean, if we were to look at legislative history, which I think Summers did look at legislative history, Landsgraf looks at legislative history, so quite apart from whether any particular judge has sensibilities about the value of legislative history, the cases suggest that we're supposed to look at that in this instance. And the legislative history doesn't help your cause here, does it?
Summers does talk about legislative history, and it also talks about that neither a committee nor a single congressman can speak for all of Congress, which the Bureau of Land Management also cited.
Isn't the meta history here kind of significant, though? I mean, is there any real doubt what Congress was trying to do in light of Buchanan and our decision in Okaw?
I think the legislative history is inconclusive. The government cites to an April 2007 committee report talking about the catalyst theory, but then Senator Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and a sponsor of the bill, on December 14th, just a few days before passage, doesn't discuss the catalyst theory. He only states that the bill clarifies.
Do you think there was any connection between Buchanan and Okaw and this act?
Senator Leahy does say that the bill clarifies that Buchanan does not apply to FOIA cases. He also says under the bill, a FOIA requester can obtain fees when he or she files a lawsuit to obtain records from the government, and it releases those records before the court orders it to do so. So, yes, Senator Leahy does talk, the legislative history does discuss overrule, pushing aside Buchanan, but it doesn't, there's nothing in that statement to suggest that it was, Congress was attempting to incorporate the catalyst theory into the bill. As I said, if Congress wanted to do so, they knew what language, they knew the magic words, and they failed to provide those in the statute. Also, I think the purpose of the amendment was to ensure that the government remain open and accessible to the American people. And I think the catalyst theory wouldn't necessarily support that position because it would be placing the burden on the plaintiff to try to figure out the thinking of the government when it released those records. The plaintiff would have to present to the court why the records were turned over, and that may be through discovery or guesswork. It is unclear. But I think that would be the problem with applying the catalyst theory, is it would take away some of the open and accessibility of government records to the public. Finally, I just want to point out that the government, in their briefs, did not talk about the district court's decision being clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion when it came to eligibility and entitlement. Therefore, Judicial Watch respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court's opinion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, just to reiterate that Summers actually says when the new legislation would increase the government's liability for past conduct.
Suppose in this case the Judicial Watch had told the government after January 1 that it was not satisfied with the search. Still not satisfied. And the government did another search, and then Judicial Watch was satisfied.
Your Honor,
would this be a different case? Would you be liable for fees under those circumstances?
We believe, under the analysis in Martin versus Haydex, that we certainly would not be liable for any of the conduct that occurred before the enactment. There may be some question as to whether the any post-enactment conduct by the government would be subject to fees. Although the Supreme Court has repeatedly, as I suggested before, referred to the fact that the new legislation to apply to pending cases must mention retroactivity.
So the fact that, as counsel said, Judicial Watch could have litigated further after January 1, right? I mean, it could have done that.
It could have.
From its perspective, the case might not have been over. Government's response to that is, that doesn't make any difference because we only look to the decision the government made in deciding whether to release the documents.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that if there was any government decision post January 1, it might be liable for fees with respect to that only.
It might.
Is that your point?
It might, under the analysis in Martin versus Haydex. Uh-huh. But Martin versus Haydex, it was also about post-judgment monitoring, which I think is different, and that generally most of the conduct taken by the government in this case was with the understanding that the Buchanan and OCAR rules applied, and therefore that conduct, the government's liability for that conduct would be increased by the retroactive application of the statute. Unless there are any further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.